Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 2nd of December 1923, Churchill on the Stump. But first, some of the other items that have caught my attention this week. Germany is yet to find a replacement for Stresemann as Chancellor. I mentioned a few weeks ago that a Rhineland Republic had been proclaimed. I haven't followed up on that, partly because there have been other more interesting things going on to the south, which is perhaps a bit unfair because if deaths are the measure of interestingness, the Rhineland separatist movement is much more interesting. Anyway, from what can be gleaned from the pages of the Times, the leaders of this organisation are chancers, the followers criminals, and the backers, I hardly believe I am saying this, the French. This week, one of the chancers, a Dr. Mathis, has been turfed out by one of the others, a Dr. Dalton. This week, the Times reported on the annual general meeting of the Royal Bank of Scotland. Oddly enough, it is still solvent. Even weirder, it has nothing to say about debanking its customers because they disagree with their politics. London has experienced its first big fog of the winter. Transport has been brought to, if not a standstill, then at least a snail's pace. A guardsman has managed to kill himself by eating a knife. On Friday, the Times carried a report on the annual general meeting of Hawarden Collieries, which had had something of a bumpy year. In those days, coal mines existed in Britain and were privately owned. The meeting was addressed by its chairman, Sir Hugh Bell. The state of the great industries in the country was most perplexing. Many of these were being carried on at a loss. In Lancashire, the cotton trade was suffering from the deepest depression. The building of ships was almost entirely suspended. In the iron trade, the prosperity of which is of supreme importance to you, such business as could be obtained was at prices involving serious loss to the manufacturers. The situation was further complicated by serious labour disputes in various branches, of which the most important was that in the boiler-making industry. Boy, that's depressing. Many times this year I have seen mention of the unemployment problem, but only this article has suggested to me at least, how bad things are. The managing director pointed out that they could have sold coal at a higher price abroad. When I tell you that during the 12 months under review, less than 12% of our coke, coke is a refined coal product used in iron production, was shipped abroad, and we should not even have sold this small percentage unless the local demand had suddenly fallen off, I think we may take credit to ourselves for having played the game in assisting home industries, thereby reducing to some extent the amount of unemployment. So, a company that is not ruthlessly focused on making a quick buck. How odd. Or maybe not. Recently I read Adrian Vaughan's Efficiency in Adversity, which is about the Great Western Railway's last year as a private company. It had a similar ethos. Here's a question. What do you think was the most popular form of road transport in 1923? Well, the Ministry of Transport has been conducting a census to find out. This is from Saturday the 1st of December. The returns generally show that in the vicinity of the large cities and towns, the bicycle is the vehicle which is used in the largest numbers. Which came as a surprise to me, although it probably shouldn't have done. A bigger surprise came in the form of a letter to the editor. This is from Tuesday the 27th of November. Sir, what percentage of the man in the street really understands the true meaning of the words tariff and fiscal? Yet the United Kingdom is going to a general election on the tariff and fiscal problems. I am, sir, truly yours, Basil Zaharoff, Paris, November the 24th. Basil Zaharoff, Sir Basil Zaharoff, no less, was an extraordinary figure. He was an arms dealer, and not one of the honest ones. He made an extraordinary amount of money both before and after the war. He also became famous. So famous that he had appeared as a character in the TV series Riley, Ace of Spies, and, thinly disguised, in the Tintin story, The Broken Ear. The knighthood, and not just any knighthood, I might add, but Knight Grand Cross of the Order of the Bath, no less, was probably due to his efforts to get Greece to join the Allied side in the First World War. And yet, here he is writing letters to the Times on philosophical matters. It doesn't exactly square with the ruthless profiteer. Winston Churchill is an interesting character to us because of what he did in the Second World War, especially 1940. But he was also an interesting character to the people of 1923, who of course were far more aware of his past failures than of his future greatness. So this week, no fewer than 5 articles and 1 letter are dedicated to his doings and sayings. This despite the fact that he hasn't been an MP for a year and holds no senior position. He was, as they say, a good copy. In the 1923 general election, he is standing for the Liberal Party in Leicester West. This is from Thursday, the 29th of November. He is personally waging an extraordinarily vigorous fight and is backed by an organisation of unlimited resources in all the arts of electioneering. The latest accession is the Daily Newspaper, which I mentioned in a former message. The Leicester United Liberal, containing full reports of Mr. Churchill's speeches, is now being left every morning at every house, not only in West Leicester, but in the whole town. Mr. Churchill makes 3 or 4 speeches daily, a fresh speech on every occasion. And this is from Tuesday. The issue in West Leicester is trembling in the balance. Mr. Churchill has, therefore, decided to remain here so that nothing may be left undone to help to turn the dread uncertainty of polling day into success, a score for free trade and a seat on the front opposition bench. Liberals are in favour of free trade. The cancelling of his engagements to speak in support of Liberal candidates in Manchester and in London gave rise to the rumour that Mr. Churchill is suffering from the overstrain of the tremendous physical and mental energy with which he is conducting his campaign. That is not so, but the truth is that the expenditure of time and strength which the task demands leaves him nothing to spare for his friends elsewhere. Clearly, being a Liberal is not as easy as it once was. The Times reported on one of his speeches on Wednesday. He said he did not see any connection between protection and unemployment. By the result of their vote, the electors would be bound not only for the 4 or 5 years that the government would last, but for perhaps the whole future of the country, because when protection was once established, the interest around it became so powerful that it had hardly been possible for any country to shake it off. Or, to put it another way, there is nothing so permanent as a temporary government scheme. And this is Thursday. Last evening, Mr. Winston Churchill had the most trying experience of his campaign at West Leicester. At a meeting at St. Leonard's School, a large number of Labour supporters gained admission, and they heckled the speaker in such a manner that he was unable to continue for some minutes. Communists trying to prevent their opponents being heard. Couldn't happen today. The subject of the Dardanelles, or Gallipoli, came up. He concluded, "The more the question of the Dardanelles had been examined, in the coldness of modern times, the more people had come to see that it was a great strategic conception, and that it took its place as probably the very best plan of the whole war for shortening the struggle." He was just as proud of his share in trying to force the Dardanelles as he was of having forced the adoption of tanks in face of opposition to a place where they became of use to our troops. Was there any great opposition to the use of tanks? Not that I'm aware of, though it must be a matter of some embarrassment to the army that the idea came from the navy. This is also from Thursday, but it covers an entirely different speech. "I was at a meeting he addressed the other night, in a little hall surrounded by streets upon streets of small brick houses. His speech, for vigour and dramatic intensity, was exactly the kind of speech he would make in the House of Commons, but I thought the audience seemed puzzled or dazed as the well-rounded and high-pitched periods, of the speaker fell on their ears." I wonder if that's a musical term. Never heard it before. Anyway, never mind. He was in the midst of a eulogium of free trade when the door was flung open and in rushed a party of young fellows and girls. Seriousness fled, and the comic spirit took possession of Mr. Churchill. "I see the dreary socialist circus has arrived," he called out hilariously. "It is made up of about half the local Labour Party, and they rush breathlessly around on bicycles to Liberal meetings instead of looking in at their own." As the hecklers yelled at him, he continued, "Now we shall hear their carefully prepared interruptions and their stock questions, which they repeat parrot-like wherever they go." Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.